Hello and welcome to the Global Energy Transition Podcast, presented by the Heinrich Böll Stiftung EU and the Global Energiewende. I am your host, Michael Buxbaum, lead blogger, photojournalist, and advisor to the energytransition.org. Though we are based in Germany, the guests and hosts of our podcast series will review how the energy transition is developing globally, while we discuss and focus upon potential solutions to the growing climate emergency. Like the blogs we publish, all our materials fall under a Creative Commons license and are therefore free for anyone to use, so long as you credit the material. As the climate crisis envelops us, we intend for this podcast series to inform listeners about additional tools being developed to deal with what's ahead. Though we may not be in the same boat, we all face the same gathering storm. The Stone Age didn't end for want of stones, and neither will the fossil fuels era, particularly since producing companies, their investors and bankers, both in wealthy and developing nations, are still moving full speed ahead to dig up ever more oil, coal, and gas deposits. As we record this in early August, the United Nations-backed International Panel on Climate Change has just told us what we already largely know, that the impacts of climate change are now widespread and pervasive. But the science is also clear that we can prevent and curtail the worst impacts of dangerous heating by immediately beginning to reduce and phase out our use of fossil fuels. For this podcast, we will be discussing a relatively new idea to help us wind down our fossil fuel dependencies, the adoption of an international fossil fuels non-proliferation treaty. Chaired by the incredible Sipora Berman, as well as a bevy of other influential climate and environmental activists, the treaty's aim is to halt further development and production, supplies in other words, instead of concentrating, as many other efforts do, on simply limiting usage and demand. Modeled in large part on the successful United Nations Global Treaty on the Non-Proliferation of Nuclear Weapons that has so far helped limit their spread to only a few nations around the world. This treaty has already been undersigned by 12 cities and subnational governments worldwide, including Vancouver, British Columbia, Barcelona, Spain, Los Angeles, and in mid-July, Toronto. Additionally, over 580 NGOs, including us here at the Heinrich Böll Stiftung, have also endorsed it, and this comes on top of tens of thousands of scientists, filmmakers, academics, activists, and concerned citizens worldwide like David Suzuki, Dr. Michael Mann, and even the Dalai Lama, who have also undersigned the treaty, an act open to all our worldwide listeners. In this podcast, we'll dive into the treaty campaign by interviewing supporters Richard Folland, a former British diplomat now serving as the government and policy affairs advisor with Carbon Tracker, and Treaty Steering Committee member Mitzi Jonel Tan of Climate Action and Fridays for Future Philippines. Stay with us. To help get a sense of where this treaty concept came from, before we hear from our two guests, we're going to play, with permission, a few excerpts from a recent interview between Sipora Berman, the Canadian-born environmental activist, campaigner, and writer who helped initiate this idea, and the ever-incisive climate and energy journalist David Roberts on a recent episode of his fantastic Volts podcast. Just a little bit about Berman. After years of fighting to save biodiversity and old-growth forests and slow tar sands mining in Alberta, Berman was asked to co-direct Greenpeace International's climate and energy program across 40 countries. And after taking on even more leadership roles on various governmental councils and NGO boards, in 2019, Berman received the $2 million Climate Breakthrough Award, intended to help create new strategies on climate change. She has since used that funding to help launch the Fossil Fuels Non-Proliferation Treaty with the intent of developing a new avenue to fight against them.
I think the theory for a long time, now almost 30 years, has been that we're going to constrain demand, you know, which is happening, obviously, more electric cars, zero emission buildings, zero emission vehicles, etc. Demand's going to go down, price is going to go up, a higher price on carbon, and the markets are going to constrain supply. And in fact, talking to my own government, and that's what I often get in Canada, we're not responsible for who produces or how much fossil fuels are produced, we're just responsible for emissions. And, you know, the thing about that market theory around demand is that it's not working. It's not working fast enough to keep us safe. That much is clear. I still actually kind of like it as a theory, you know, but the fact is that there are two big problems with it. One is that the markets are completely distorted by fossil fuel subsidies and now by governments out and out buying projects that the industry runs away from. So renewables, as you know, are cheap. Cheaper in some places than fossil fuels. In a lot of places now, oil and gas companies operating at the bottom of the S&P, more bankruptcies in that sector than any other. But these projects are still surviving, like the Trans Mountain Pipeline in my own country, Canada. It's surviving because investors ran away from it and government bought it, you know, for $12 billion. And so that's because of the political influence of the fossil fuel industry and because governments are only just starting to really grapple with the fact that they're going to actually need to deal with supply as well as demand.
One of the huge challenges to slowing down fossil fuel development worldwide, which sometimes feels like an endless game of whack-a-mole, like Robert says, is the lack of information as to how much and where development is actually occurring. That's why the Treaty Initiative has focused on publishing a registry of how much fossil fuels are actually being produced.
Our kind of state of knowledge about fossil fuels in the world, like where they're being dug up and how much and who's doing it. And, you know, I guess I just maybe in the back of my head, I don't know why now looking back on it, but I guess I just sort of assumed that, like, we know that there's a somewhere that's written down. Like, some people keep, of course, people are keeping track of that. But no, turns out not. So start maybe with the registry idea and just kind of tell us about, like, what is the state of knowledge currently about global fossil fuel production?
Well, you know, the first time I read a kind of roundup of who's producing what, at least on oil and gas, and how much is planned production, because we started thinking, okay, well, so if the scientists and even Mark Carney is out there saying we have to keep 2/3 of fossil fuels in the ground. Right. How much are we currently planning on producing? I also thought it would be an easy question to answer. And what we now know is that countries are responsible for submitting emissions data to the UN and domestically, and that's all easy to find. If you want to count up today who's producing what and how much, you have to buy the data from Rystad or Wood Mackenzie. And that's, fact, what Oil Change International has been doing for years in producing its Sky's Limit reports. That's what Stockholm Environment Institute is doing in producing the Production Gap Report. So most governments themselves don't even know what's being produced in there, or don't have anywhere that they counted up what's being produced and how much.
No kidding. So these private databases are the only places where that information exists?
If you dig deep at a national government level, you can find it. And there are great experts out there like Pete Erickson from Stockholm Environment Institute and others who can do this. If you're an average person, or even, it turns out, as I've discussed in several countries, a minister, you can't find it.
Wow.
And you don't know what's being produced. So intransigent issues like this that are global issues, nuclear weapons, landmines, etc., the first piece in a global reckoning is accountability and transparency. In fact, that would be the first piece at a national level as well.
Right.
Like, and we don't have transparency or accountability. We don't even have a comprehensive database of how much coal, oil, and gas reserves, resources, and production is happening globally at any given time. It's not even accessible to decision makers, let alone publicly accessible.
As Berman explains, without a registry detailing how much fossil fuel stock is actually being produced, there's just no way to know how much is already locked in.
The first critical piece in this puzzle was the Production Gap Report that the Stockholm Environment Institute produced with the United Nations Environment Program, ISD, and others. And it's that report that started crunching the global numbers and said for the first time, you know, We're currently on track to produce 120% more fossil fuels than the world can ever safely burn under a 1.5 degree scenario. And that, in fact, we already have enough oil, gas, and coal either above ground or under production to take us past 2 degrees. So,
wow.
So the majority of the world's financial, political, and intellectual capital at this moment in history is going to produce three products, oil, gas, and coal, which are responsible for 80% of the emissions trapped in our atmosphere, three products which we can't use if we want to have a stable climate.
Set to launch at COP26 later this year as an open access database, the data is already revealing how lopsided the discussion is around which nations are producing beyond their feasible limits.
But actually, what we're finding with both the registry and the fossil fuel treaty is that it's actually governments in the global south are pretty interested in this type of transparency. Once we show them the data that shows that the majority of expansion for fossil fuels, the far majority, well over 70% of the expansion planned for fossil fuels in the next 5 years is in the global north. It's in wealthy countries.
Oh, interesting. The very countries that are most vocally talking about climate change, right?
I mean, that's right. In fact, the far majority of what is planned globally on oil and gas is in the U.S. and Canada.
While we know that many nations, particularly developing nations, are only producing fossil fuels to service their outstanding debts and not because they need the energy, what is less well understood, as Berman points out in this last clip, is how expensive fossil fuels expansion is already becoming from a health costs perspective.
And we know from the data that's coming out that fossil fuel use and development, especially actually in the global south, is costing millions, if not billions, in health costs. Because it's toxic, right? We've always known that. Sure, we've benefited from this industry. Lots of great, nice people work in this industry. Now we know, like nuclear weapons, that the expansion of it is killing us. And that's the parallel. And that's, I think, the beauty of the treaty that we haven't really talked about is that the climate movement hasn't had a global demand to governments since well before Paris, except for, you know, increased ambition and, you know, complicated things that actually don't mean anything to the average person.
Higher targets. It's always the targets.
What does that even mean? And what the Fossil Fuel Nonproliferation Treaty does, I think, is start to shift the norm around fossil fuels. Because we've all grown up with the idea that fossil fuels are prosperity, that they're keeping you know, the lights on. And in countries or places like Texas or Alberta where you see production, it's also what keeps your hospitals open and your roads paved. In fact, that's not true anymore. Because in both jurisdictions, actually, and in which this is a trend in most wealthy countries, we're spending more money for fossil fuel production than fossil fuel production provides to a subnational or to a nation state because of the liability costs, because of the lack of the royalties going down, subsidies going up, et cetera. We're paying them to extract and pollute now. That's what's happening.
The whole of the David Roberts interview with Berman is riveting. I'll link to it in our show notes. And thanks again to David and Canary Media for allowing us to excerpt from it. Now I'd like to bring in our two guests, first Richard Folland and then Mitzi Tan. Joining us from his office south of London, Richard is a retired diplomat with the British Foreign Office who focused on international energy policy throughout most of his long career. Since 2014, he has served as Carbon Tracker's policy and government affairs advisor. Richard, thanks for coming on the podcast. And let me start our conversation by asking why you have chosen to support this treaty initiative.
I think it's an absolutely terrific vehicle to address the fossil fuel supply side agenda. And what I mean by that is that if one looks at how policymakers and what has gone on in the UN negotiations on climate change, if one looks at the Paris Climate Agreement, which is, of course, extremely important and was a massive step forward in terms of the international community addressing climate change. But what's been done there internationally, but also so much in terms of domestic policy measures by governments as well, have concentrated on the fossil fuel demand side, but not the supply side. And over the last 18 months, alongside the development of the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty campaign, but also really acting as important foundations and evidence for what we say, some major reports have come forward, notably from UNEP, the UN Environment Protection Agency, in collaboration with the Stockholm Environment Institute and other research organizations, addressing what they call the production gap. And the key messages that have come out of the UNEP reports is to say that it's not enough to address the demand side, but that if we're going to meet the Paris goals and limit global warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, then these issues of fossil fuel production, of fossil fuel supply, have to be addressed. The UNEP report specifically says that we need collectively this decade, by 2030, to reduce oil, gas and coal production by on average 6% year on year. So that's a very strong message coming out from UNEP. And this was backed up quite recently by a major report from the International Energy Agency. It was a landmark report from them, from the IEA, looking at the pathway, a scenario to net zero and a 1.5 degrees centigrade limited pathway. And a central conclusion from the IEA report was that there should be no investment in new oil and gas production, an extremely powerful message coming from them as well. So coming back to your question, the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty campaign is, in my view, a great vehicle, a great campaigning vehicle, a public vehicle to address the supply side agenda. I've been delighted to be part of the work on this in helping to take the initiative forward.
Most of us are veterans of various campaigns, as are you, Richard. Why and how do you believe this project, this tactic really, will succeed where others haven't?
I think this treaty initiative, the campaign, is resonating already, and its chances of success are better and of succeeding where other attempts haven't succeeded, for two reasons. One, because it's a genuinely global campaign. It's involving a variety of organizations from civil society, both in the global north and in the global south. And that's extremely important that it has that very strong international represented in each continent. My second point goes back to the answer that I gave previously when I talked about the fossil fuel supply side now coming more onto the international agenda through what we've been hearing from organisations like UNEP and from the IEA, that it seems to me that the time has come for an initiative like this. Perhaps 5 years ago, it would have been more difficult. The timing wouldn't have been right then. If you look at Paris, it doesn't mention fossil fuels at all. But, you know, it seems to me that there is much more of a platform, people understanding this more now, that, you know, if we're going to tackle this this enormous challenge, the climate challenge, that oil, gas and coal production, we just can't afford to go on expanding production in the way that we have, that really has got to be addressed by governments by companies and by those of us in civil society.
As a career diplomat, how is the treaty idea resonating with your peers?
So I think it's fair to say that we do get some challenge, whether it's in the UK or in Europe more generally, to the treaty that say diplomats or policymakers that I talk to, some will wonder about the ambition of what we're trying to achieve, the time it could take. We'll throw up the geopolitical challenges, but also the people I talk to in governments, they understand the initiative in terms, as I was describing earlier, of it being a powerful vehicle, really to help to drive this agenda, to be able to help to change the narrative internationally in how we tackle climate change. They understand the systems change approach that we're taking. We're saying, right, you know, we have this strong public campaign, but also that we need to address the supply side in the political, the diplomatic sense, and that, you know, one needs to come forward with solutions here, but also a key aspect of the treaty campaign that a managed and equitable transition has to be at the heart of how we take things forward as well. We are seeing some really encouraging actions being taken by European governments on tackling fossil fuel supply. If I think of Denmark, if I think of Sweden, both of whom have introduced legislation during the last 12 months to restrict fossil fuel production, oil and gas production on their territories. We see other governments in Europe starting to consider this as well. So that is encouraging as far as we're concerned.
Thanks, Richard, for your insights and commitment, and of course, for coming on to our podcast. Next, we're traveling to the other side of the world, to Manila, to hear from Steering Committee member Mitzi Janelle Tan in the Philippines. Mitzi works with several groups there, and, well, maybe it's just best if she explains.
I'm a full-time climate justice activist based in Metro Manila, Philippines. Since I'm a full-time climate activist, this is everything that I do. A lot of my work goes with organizing in my national group, which is called Youth Advocates for Climate Action Philippines, but I also organize with Fridays for Future MAPA, which is Most Affected Peoples and Areas, a term we like to use alongside the term Global South, and also in Fridays for Future International. A lot of what I'm doing in the national scene is raising awareness about the climate crisis and really contextualizing climate education and climate science to what's happening in the Philippines, and also campaigning against fossil fuels at the same time. And it echoes, I guess, in the same way in the regional organizing and in the international organizing, just different ways of awareness raising. So here in the Philippines, it's about climate science, but in international scenes, it's more about colonialism and how people from the global south were not victims, and we're not just helpless people, right? It's more of a narrative shifting kind of awareness raising.
Mitzi, let me ask you the same question I asked Richard. You're already super engaged in so many different efforts. Why did you choose to get on board this initiative?
So the reason why I decided to support the Fossil Fuel Non-Proliferation Treaty, which is a mouthful, so I'll just be calling it the Fossil Fuel Treaty from now on, is because of how effective it is. It's definitely something that aligns with what I'm already doing in terms of raising awareness and shifting narratives. So one of the things that I like all of it, but one of the things that I really, really like is the use of the word non-proliferation, even if it's such a mouthful, because it's the same term that was used during the nuclear weapons time when they did a non-proliferation treaty then. And so it shifts a narrative to show that the fossil fuel industry is a mass destructive weapon. It's something that's killing people today. And so that alone was enough to like catch my attention. And then I got into the treaty more and I saw how it aligns with my messaging of climate justice, of how we have to stop and end all new exploration and production of coal, oil, and gas, and then have a phase out and a just transition, not leaving behind the workers and the most marginalized people. And the global approach is so important because otherwise you end up with countries assuming that what they're doing is enough. But if you don't coordinate these things, then you'll end up having some countries left behind and having some countries not doing enough, even if these countries, the global north countries, are the ones that are more responsible.
I get that we're all looking for new tactics in this fight against fossil fuels and fight for the climate. So how and why do you think this treaty initiative will succeed where other attempts haven't?
One of it is the really truly global approach, but also a very grassroots local approach. So let me explain that a bit. So you have the idea of doing this on a global level, the treaty, but the way you're approaching people is by community, by city, by municipality, by country. And so what's also so cool about the treaty is that you can endorse as an organization, as a corporation, or even as a city, state, or province. If you can get, we already have a few cities and states with us. And if with those cities, it's such a big pusher towards national government eventually signing on also, because then you have this city with you and it's like, oh, this city is on our side, right? And once you also get your city or your state or your province on your side, then when there are projects of fossil fuel industries there, then you can kind of go back to them and say, hey, you signed this treaty. You have to say something about this project that's being put up in our city.
So what's the level of conversation about the climate where you are, Mitzi, and are you already campaigning around the idea of a fossil fuel phase out? And for that matter, what kind of traction are you getting so far?
There is definitely a lot of conversation about phasing out fossil fuels. There is already a moratorium on coal plants, coal-fired power plants here. However, it's not strictly imposed. And the way that it's talked about isn't necessarily connected to the climate crisis, but more of like renewable energy, more sustainable, not connecting it to how we're already experiencing the impacts of these fossil fuel industries. And so when we don't connect it to these things, when people don't understand the connection of the climate crisis and the fossil fuel industry, there's less of an urgency, I would say. And this lack of connection comes from our lack of education and lack of climate education and climate awareness. Because if you have access to quality education, what you'll be taught is how the ice caps are melting and the polar bears. And it's all very important, but it's not about how what we're already experiencing, the typhoons that we experience year after year with about an average of 20 per year, is because of the climate crisis, which is mainly being caused by the fossil fuel industry.
One of the points that both Sapora made with David Roberts on Volts and that Richard also mentioned is the absolute injustice that though rich countries like the United States or Germany and much of the global north are responsible for most of the emissions pushing global warming, it's the global south that is experiencing a disproportionate amount of the impacts.
Yeah, exactly. Like the Philippines, we only contribute up to 0.4%, less than that, to carbon dioxide emissions worldwide. The Asia in particular is one of the most vulnerable regions to the climate crisis, yet we also have in Asia some of the biggest funders of the fossil fuel industry. So there's this disconnect where we have, for example, Japan, one of the largest banks that's funding fossil fuel industries across the globe is Japan, but Japan is also experiencing so many climate impacts, and it's like, do you not see that what you're investing in is also ruining your own communities already?
So what kind of acceptance are you getting there on the ground with the treaty idea, and how are folks getting involved?
So we're starting to reach out to different groups in Asia, and you can really see at least most of what I do in the treaty work is reaching out to the youth in Asia. And so there's a lot of excitement there because it's something that you can start with in your own community, right? Like you can endorse it as an individual, you can endorse it as an organization, and then you can come together and ask your municipality or your city to endorse it. And it's something that's very tangible, something that you can do. And if it's dangerous to protest in your country, like a lot of it, like in a lot of countries in Asia, then this is kind of like a formal legal way to let your demands be heard, but also keep you a little bit safer, and can be really, really good and strategic in the long term. So there's definitely a lot of excitement, and we're planning a lot of things in the youth space of the Fossil Fuel Treaty in the next couple of months. So definitely look out for that also.
So are you seeing the levels of activism growing then as more disasters come, as more islands get flooded out? Or are you seeing more people getting involved?
Rather than islands being wiped out, it's more of like my city, Marikina City, is one of the most flooded areas in the capital. And last year, the strongest storm landfall in recorded history hit the Philippines. And then just a week after that, a month's worth of rain poured under 24 hours. And that was the fourth storm in 3 weeks. So because of all those typhoons hitting one after the other and the intensity of each of those typhoons, people were left stranded on their rooftops, 40 feet or 12 meters high. There was no electricity in the city for days. And even after that, there was mud everywhere and we had to help clean up houses. And it's just, it's this everyday kind of devastation. And it's not something that you're supposed to get used to. And that's my worry also, that people start to get desensitized and think that this is an act of God, because that's also what's being portrayed in media, that this is just another typhoon. There is nothing that we can do about it, but there is something that we can do about it. And that's where the treaty also comes in, because then you have this concrete thing that you can go to your mayors, you can go to your local government officials and say, you're also experiencing the typhoons and the devastation that we're experiencing. This is something that we need to do and we need to work on.
Maybe we should follow Bill McKibben's idea and start naming these storms after fossil fuel companies instead of giving them human names, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like you're seeing how the way that they advertise and they push individual changes to climate and say that they're doing great renewable energy resources and they're doing all these great things, but still trying to put the blame on the consumer. It's really just telling of how these fossil fuel industries will cling their way in and hold on as tight as they can as people. And, you know, the planet is literally pulling them off of the podium that they're trying to stay on top of, right? You're seeing how the fossil fuel industry, it is a rotting industry, and people, more and more people are seeing it. And what we have to be really careful of next is that they don't go into some other kind of thing. Because, for example, just to look at like the plastic waste happening across the globe, people think that climate justice activists and zero waste activists are different things, but who creates the plastic? It's also the fossil fuel industry. So we also have to be careful that as we push them out of the energy sector, they don't just keep polluting and go on to the plastic sector instead.
Mitzi, thank you so much for your time and insights and for coming on the pod. How can folks connect with you? How can they join in and follow you online going forward?
So you guys can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Mitzi Jonelle, MitziJonelle. Thank you so much, Michael. I hope you have a good rest of the day.
And thanks to all of you who have tuned in and stayed tuned in. Once again, I am your host, Michael Buxbaum, and you have been listening to the Global Energy Transition Podcast, a new series presented by the Heinrich Boll Stiftung EU and the Global Energiewende. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Energiewende, GER, and you can find me at L. Michael Buxbaum. Thanks again to our guests, Mitzi Jonelle Tan and Richard Folland. And thanks again to David Roberts and Canary Media. Please look for the link to the Volts podcast in our show notes. Thanks also to the Energy Transition team in the EU office in Brussels, Lisa Tostado, Martin Keim, and Joan Lafranco. And a big thanks to this podcast's amazing producer, the sound guru and soon-to-be-famous bass player, Christian Kreimborg. From the former German capital city of Bonn, I wish you all smooth sailing on what may be rough seas ahead. Until next time.